little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
For this episode, I want to remind our listeners that Julie and I did a very basic introduction to AI, that's artificial intelligence, on episode number 83, because we think it's important for everybody to begin to get some understanding of this technology, which is already affecting our lives and I suspect is going to gain even greater momentum for doing so in the future. And the point we were trying to make there was that it's worth the effort to acquire knowledge about AI to help us resist the seductive, simplified, and polarized narratives of either, for example, thinking that AI is going to solve all our problems and give us a life of leisure, or that belief that AI will ultimately cause the end of human civilization. The intriguing thing for me about AI is that in attempting to replicate intelligence, we are really naturally led to explore what intelligence, reasoning, and knowledge are, and the processes required to achieve them, and the implications that has for human thought, belief, and decision making. So in this edition of Thinking Clearly, we're all hooked up with a great guest to help us explore these topics.
And today's topics are going to be the concept of educability and the new theory of human uniqueness, how developing artificial intelligence takes us on a deep dive to understanding human cognition, the importance of trust and shared knowledge, and the advantages of tolerance for inconsistency.
And our guest, Leslie Valiant, built his higher level educational foundation in the UK. First at Cambridge, where he earned a BA in mathematics, and then Imperial College London for a diploma in computing science, and from there to Warwick University, where he received his PhD in computer science back in 1974. And he's currently T. Jefferson Coolidge Professor of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard University, where he's been teaching since about 1982. Professor Valiant has a number of awards for his work in mathematics and computer science, including the prestigious A.M. Turing Award back in 2010. And that award sometimes is called the Nobel Prize of Computing. And the citation on the award webpage reads, this is a quote, "For transformative contributions to the theory of computation, including the theory of probably approximately correct learning, the complexity of enumeration, algebraic computation, and the theory of parallel and distributed computing." Professor Valiant is the author of countless professional articles and three books, Circuits of the Mind, Probably Approximately Correct, and his most recent book, which will be coming out, I believe, in April, The Importance of Being Educable, A New Theory of Human Uniqueness. Professor Valiant, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so glad you could join us. I think we'll just dive right in and maybe start by examining some of the key words in the title of your new book, The Importance of Being Educable, A New Theory of Human Uniqueness. So, what does it mean to be educable? And what makes that important? And what is this new theory of human uniqueness? I'll just kind of throw all those questions at you from the get-go.
Roughly the phenomenon I'm trying to address is that clearly humans are very successful in changing the world and impacting the world. And what we do all the time is to interact with information. So we read novels all the time. We listen to podcasts. We go to courses at universities for years sometimes. We're obsessed with our cell phones. So I'm trying to capture the main phenomenon by which we acquire and process information, which is, I think, our human secret. So the word educability in the book I'm trying to define as precisely as a new concept, but it's clearly intended to hark back to our conventional notion of being educated. So it's trying to capture how we access information, how we process it, and how we use it. So basically, it's a cognitive capability, and so we can talk about it at greater length, but very roughly, it's got three components. One is being able to learn by experience. This is learning from examples. The second one is to be able to chain together what we've learned. And this is some kind of basic reasoning. And the third way is to be also to be able to learn not by from direct experience, but from someone telling us about their experience. So in other words, someone giving us a lecture about how physics is, for example. And so we've got a capability which combines these three methods of acquiring information. And also part of this is also applying information. So when we acquire information, it doesn't just sit there like in an encyclopedia. It's kind of ready to be used. So this capability I'm trying to define, you know, fairly precisely as a cognitive capability, which I think humans have, and which I think makes us unique among other species.
And how does the human evolved capacity of educability relate to a person's like system of belief? And how does that make that a game changer for us humans as a species?
So some of what I've described, some of these abilities are common with animals. So they go back a long way in evolution, probably over a billion years. But certainly what's special to humans and other animals have much less is being able to take on other people's beliefs. So in learning from experience, you go around and maybe you see that elephants have tusks, and they do have tusks, and you see many elephants with tusks, and you learn that, and that's kind of a true world. But if someone tells you a theory, which you can't verify for yourself, then you really have to trust them for its truth. So as humans, we absorb a vast amount of information, which is not from our direct experience, but from other people's experience. And of course, this is partly our power, that, you know, this vast edifice of science, which has been built up by, you know, tens of thousands of researchers, you know, a single person can acquire by believing what they tell us. But it's all based on trust, because the mechanism which allows us to absorb other people's beliefs in so easily also allows us to absorb beliefs which aren't true.
I was just thinking about this, trying to put this in the context of what I know about other animals other than humans. We know that there are other social species where social interaction is important. But it seems like what you're talking about with educability, I want to say educability, but what is it about human beings, do you think, that led to us advancing the social interaction and social skills to the point where we could actually pass on information and accumulate information and develop culture?
My angle on this is marginally different from maybe what you're implying. So I don't think that we acquired some, you know, social skills which made us able to do all this. I think we acquired a cognitive skill in our minds, a way of processing information, which allowed us to able to learn. So basically, if I describe to you some complicated procedure for doing something, you can memorize the procedure and execute it. But in the animal kingdom, being given explicit instructions like this, of course, how do you give them the instructions? Usually not in words. In principle, you can do it by some sort of physical demonstration. And so animals can do this to a small extent. I think what we humans have is a kind of a cognitive brain ability to be able to interpret some long sequence of instructions and incorporate them and execute them as if we had learned it for ourselves from personal experience. I think the primitive thing which should be evolved to do is to learn from experience. And that's how animals learn. And somehow on top of this, we acquire this extra capability of being able to take these instructions. So discussing, you know, social, of course, many animals are social, we are social, but I don't think these social behaviors by themselves explain anything without having this capability, which isn't so trivial.
So it's kind of a synergy between our sociability and these cognitive values that have been developed evolutionarily.
Yes, I don't quite know exactly what you mean by sociability. Certainly, someone in isolation can learn a lot by reading books and watching the internet. So it's not even so much interacting with other people, it's just an ability to be able to cognitively absorb knowledge given in this explicit form, like you can learn about quantum mechanics in a course given very abstractly, but you know you can do it. It's a cognitive capability independent of our interactions with other people.
Well, I was really impressed with your book. I read an advanced copy of that book, and I think it has a great appeal to a wide variety of people. It has great ideas, both to those who are interested in more effective pathways, AI developers, for example, and also to those people that are striving to learn more about how humans process information, and also a host of others, for example, those who are interested in complexity and emergence, which you discuss somewhat in that book. And as we've been talking about the evolution of human civilization and so on. So I think it has an appeal to a lot of different people. But since our time is limited, we're hoping here to focus mostly on your work, its implications, I might say, for understanding human cognition. And in a general sense, how has your work as a theoretical computer scientist, including your work on probably approximately correct learning. Can we call that PAC learning? What's the acronym?
We can. That's in fact what.
Okay. How does that shed light on human cognition?
Well, that's a great question. So in fact, in the book, which I actually wrote 2 or 3 years ago, I go to a lot of trouble to try to explain how computer science, which is what I do, can give you theories of cognition and bypassing immediate experiments on humans. But in the last year, this explanation has become much simpler because of ChatGPT. So one explanation would be that ChatGPT has phenomena which remind people of cognitive phenomena of human behavior in a very strong way. So people are even frightened of it. They think this is the most cognitive artifact we've made. All ChatGPT does is it implements the simplest notion of machine learning and computer science, which is learning by example, which is one of the three parts of my definition of educability. So ChatGPT basically is a system which is good at predicting the next syllable given some text. And it is trained by a machine learning method. So the PAC learning model, which I devised maybe 40 years ago. So that's the definition of what you expect a machine learning system to be able to do before you declare it successful. So basically, it says that if you train it, you give it examples, say examples of pictures, and then you label it whether it's an elephant or not. And then in the future, when you give it another example, it should accurately predict whether the future example is an elephant or not. But the definition has a quantitative aspect, which is that you should be able to do this fairly efficiently, that you shouldn't need an infinite number of examples before you can generalize correctly. The definition is such that the more effort you make in the training, the better the prediction should be. But this better and better should be good enough that you're adequately rewarded for the more effort. So maybe if you make 10 times as much effort in computation and data, you should, if you improve by such a percentage, then if you make another 10 times more effort, you should you should improve by, again, a similar percentage. So it's a quantitative requirement on how much your prediction should improve. And so the current machine learning methods, as these ChatGPT, basically have exactly this behavior. You give it more data, it predicts better. So I think in answer to your question, I would say that in computer science, there's some very powerful ideas. Of course, Alan Turing was the originator of some of the most powerful ideas in computer science. So computer science has very powerful ideas which capture important aspects of the world. And so these chatbots can be made to look like human behavior much more than anything else previously made. And I think it's accurate to say that there's very little cognitive science put into their creation. There's probably none. There's very little linguistics put into it, very little neuroscience. It's just a realization of a very simple, abstract computational idea. So basically, that's kind of the purpose of my book, is to pursue this a bit further, that just this pack learning is successful. I think what current AI systems do are basically realizations of pack learning. Of course, this realization has a lot of features. You know, it has to be trained on good data, a lot of money has to be spent, etc., etc. But scientifically, it's a realization of a very simple phenomenon. And so what the book is about is trying to see what other simple computational definitions one needs to add to capture a broader part of the human cognitive system.
You mentioned ChatGPT, and on the previous episode we did on AI, we talked about that. In fact, we interviewed ChatGPT and gave a little demonstration of how it works. And that's an example of a large language model. And as we develop our ideas here, I'm hoping to also get into the idea of, in addition to that approach, large language models, what else needs to come into the picture in developing AI to supplement just what large language models do? We don't have to get into that right now, but I want to move in that direction because we have you, a theoretical computer scientist with a long and illustrious career. So it's a privilege to actually tap into your knowledge and background a little bit because Julie and I were just sort of winging it in that episode that we did. We're novices. So enlighten us wherever we need to, because we'd really appreciate that. But let's start out talking about what some of these terms are. Real simply, information processing. Everybody talks about IP, information processing. What is that really?
Well, in my understanding, it's the same as computation. 70 years ago, 80 years ago, Sir Alan Turing gave a formal definition of computation, and this is exactly what current computers realize. And this is a very robust notion that, you know, if you make variants of it in theory, you get the same thing back. So I think the notion of computation information processing are used synonymously. One shouldn't try to add other meanings to it. There's a technical definition. It's what computers do. Of course, Turing also realized and also aimed to describe not just computers, but also other things in the universe like the brain. And so in computer science, what's called the Church-Turing thesis states that what computers in the conventional sense can compute is exactly the same as the most powerful things in the universe could possibly compute, the most powerful mechanistic systems, including brains. So I think a very important aspect of computer science is that it was part of Turing's ambition to describe computation in an abstract sense, whether done by computers, neurons, or whatever. And people believe that he succeeded. So I think the our general notion of computation, information processing, we should be confident in as being a very robust notion. And it's all the same thing, I think.
In your view, information processing and computation are synonymous. We can use those terms interchangeably.
Yes.
How about another term that's really thrown around a lot? People talk about it, and I think most people don't have the foggiest notion what it really is. Algorithm.
Well, no. So an algorithm, that's also very, very specific. It's a procedure, a recipe. So computation is specified by an algorithm. So an algorithm tells you what steps to take, like a cookery recipe. Then when you execute the cookery recipe, you're doing a computation. So it's like a computer program. It's like an algorithm, except people usually think of the term algorithm as a slightly more general level, kind of abstract on a big scale, and, you know, what are the steps you're going to take, and the program may go down to smaller details.
So an algorithm could be just a description using language. It doesn't have to use mathematics.
Sure, yes. If it's an Yeah, preferably it should be unambiguous to people who are using it, so it should be clear to whoever is talking about it what it would do, yes.
Okay. How about the term emergence?
Well, that I think is a vague term, which I think I don't subscribe to entirely because I don't quite know what it means. But I think it's used in the sense of that if you do something complicated and you can't predict what's going to happen, but something interesting does happen, you got some behavior, then you call it an emergent behavior because you couldn't predict, you couldn't explain exactly why you got that behavior. So I think it seems to be an expression relative to your previous knowledge somehow that it's not a behavior which is, so maybe even if you run a computer program, you know, some of its behavior you may not be able to predict. And then you say, oh, it's the emergent behavior.
You say you don't subscribe to it completely. What are your reservations about emergence?
The word emergence seems to be used in the senses in which we don't understand what's going on. And I think just having a general notion of what we don't understand what's going on doesn't seem to be that useful because
okay.
Those phenomena may not have much in common.
And I'm not meaning to put you on the spot here. I'm trying to really get into these issues. And I want to know, because a lot of people use that term emergence, and they're excited about using emergence as an idea. It becomes almost a mystical idea for, like you say, things that aren't understood. So, but you do refer to emergence in your book. So
I don't think so.
Is it your position then that most things that we see as emergent, we don't understand the details enough to explain them, or?
Well, I'm just trying to explain how the word seems to be used by other people.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not trying to be totally negative because it may be that in one particular domain, you go so far and then you don't understand the phenomena and you're still excited by the phenomena. You say, oh, these emergent phenomena are a bit exciting. So I'm not trying to say negative things about it, but I think it's hard to study emergent behavior because it seems to be defined negatively as things we don't understand.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a useful term for some people. I'm not objecting to it. I don't use it, no.
So it's not a concept that you use in your theory and your understanding of what's going on.
No.
Well, going back to something Bob had mentioned earlier, which was your work on probably approximately correct, or PAC for short. PAC learning, you know, sounds like it relates to something that Bob and I have talked about before on the show, the Bayesian approach, which is, you know, for those who don't know, a statistical method for revising our beliefs or the predictions that we have based on new information that's presented. How does probably approximately correct learning compare with Bayesian updating?
Well, one difference is that it's a different level. So PAC learning tries to describe what you need to achieve to be able to generalize effectively, independent of what the method you use for doing the generalization. And the Bayesian method, when used in this context, is one of the methods you may try to use to make predictions. In machine learning, you've got an algorithm. So deep learning is one algorithm. Bayesian update is another algorithm, and there are many others. And in different contexts, they're differently successful. Okay, so I have to explain. So in PAC learning, the learner doesn't actually use probabilities. Probably approximately correct means that in the world, there are different examples, say pictures presented to you, and you have to classify them whether they're elephants or not. And the issue is, you know, with what probability your classification is correct. But you know, you just say yes, no, yes, no. There's no probability of belief. So the Bayesian method is just one particular approach which you can use to machine learning and other things. You assign probabilities to your belief in various possibilities, and then you update it in the light of new experience. So it's useful for systems which you know a lot about. So for example, if you want to diagnose what's wrong with your car and your car doesn't start, you may think that the possible reasons may be the following three reasons, but different probabilities. And then you get some information, like you look at the lights, then you may update these probabilities. So this is a method of predicting things, but it works in limited domains. So for example, you know, These large language models, they don't use Bayesian reasoning because it just won't work. The brief answer is that you can use Bayesian reasoning as one method of machine learning, whereas pack learning is a criterion on when machine learning methods have succeeded or not.
What's the relationship between pack learning and the inductive method versus the deductive logical methodology?
That's a question close to my heart. So when I started working on this about 40 years ago, for example, one quote which I found, a famous quote from Aristotle, which says that all belief comes from syllogism or induction. And so by syllogism, he meant logic in the sense I think generally used. And induction was something different. And of course, philosophers pursued this notion of induction for centuries. The question is, how on earth can you classify a picture whether it's an elephant or not if you haven't seen it before? You know, it's self-contradictory also. And philosophers had trouble in identifying what induction is. And so I think a contribution of machine learning theory is in fact to address this classical problem of philosophy, because I think philosophers didn't have a good answer to what induction was. I studied the literature a bit. And so I think we computer scientists gave a meaning to it. So it may not cover all senses in which the word induction is used by philosophers over the centuries, but it gives an explanation of induction in a very concrete context. So, for example, the fact that children around the world learn words for a chair and a table and a dog, and they've seen different examples, but arrive at surprisingly similar notions. They don't disagree very much. It's an amazing phenomenon. And this is the kind of phenomenon which machine learning theory addresses. And of course, it also practices in practical machine learning. So machine learning is good at categorizing pictures of things. So I think, in my view, the word induction used to be a pretty vague word. And then machine learning gives a very practical incarnation of the issue and a good answer to it. Machine learning has answered a philosophical question, maybe not exactly as the question was asked, but in a relevant way. Whereas I think deduction is usually associated with traditional logic, where you've got certainty and you have facts which regard as certain, and then you chain them together to get other deductions.
Julia has a background in philosophy. We had a philosopher of science, Lee McIntyre, on a few shows. We've had him three times guest. And Lee was trying to get me to understand the idea that I think this is what he was trying to get me to understand, is that knowledge itself, and help me out on this, Julia, knowledge itself, to really call it knowledge, had to be based on deductive reasoning. And inductive reasoning, I wanted to argue, is allowing probability into the realm of what knowledge can be. And he had a hard time getting it through my head because I have background in science and mathematics, and we deal with probability all the time. So is that kind of what pack learning is? It's placing within the realm of something that we can call knowledge things that have a inductive probability of happening?
Yes, for sure. So I think, your friends seem to have a very strict view of what knowledge is. So I think, yeah, for sure. So I think this kind of validates, I think, your intuitive notion. So instead of knowledge, so maybe I would talk about skills. So actually in a previous book, I had this notion of, again, to explain pack learning, the notion of that some things we do are theory full, like if you do mathematics, there's a theory or physics or science, or sometimes also the law and maybe even the rules of sport. We're following some rules. But there are other aspects of life where we don't know what the rules are, but we can still do things very skillfully. So, for example, in forming a good English sentence, we can do, although we don't know exactly what the rules are, and the suggestion was that we do this by learning from examples, pack learning. And of course, this is exactly what these large language models do. And what I was trying to say is that the skills we get from learning from experience are just as valid as the, or I wouldn't say just as valid, but they're just as important to us as the skills we get from some formal study where we can do logical reasoning because we're so certain of the facts. And in fact, most of human activity is of the second kind, where we act skillfully, but that's because we've learned from many, many examples, have experience, and it's inductive in any sense of the word. So separating the two kinds of ways of doing things, I would hesitate to do, because in fact I think this notion of educability is centered on the fact that what we're good at is to combine the two. So that's what human skill is, that we can learn things in a classroom about something axiomatic, but we've got our common sense knowledge, which is inductive, and we're good at combining it all. We've got one system in which we can do all of this. So I think to understand human cognition, we should combine these two rather than separate them.
It sounds like what some people might call street smarts and book smart.
Yeah, but I think the mystery is that we can combine the two, I think. And all the time, we do it all the time. That, you know, most of what we do is probably street smart, but we can be informed by what we read to do a bit better, okay? So I think the mystery of how we combine this is, I think, a big part of what I address in the book on educability.
Continuing with this theme of taking some of your concepts and ideas and trying to relate them to what we have already talked about on this show or thought about, you have a concept we haven't talked about yet called the mind's eye. But they sort of remind me of other things that we've discussed on Thinking Clearly, those being something called reality as controlled hallucination. And that comes from the work of Anil Seth, who's a professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex. We've not had Professor Seth as a guest yet, but in episode 43, Julie and I discussed some of his ideas. So my understanding of Anil Seth's view is that our subjective experience, or you might call it consciousness, is kind of a best guess as to what's out there based on sensory data coming in. And explaining his use of the term controlled hallucination, which is something that, you know, just boggles the mind. What is a controlled hallucination? But he explains it like this. He says, and this is a quote, "Everything that we perceive is a construction, but it's not a random construction. It's a best guess as to what is reined in by the sensory data at all times, which is why most of us agree when we look at a table that we'll say, yeah, that's a table. You see a table. We both see the same thing. And that's because there aren't just random constructions. There are folks that believe that reality is our construction. So Anil Seth is not saying that to that degree. So he's saying because these aren't just random constructions, they're constrained by the sensory data that we get. And that's why I think the term controlled hallucination is very appropriate," end quote. So how do you put all that together and integrate some of those ideas with your approaches? For example, is your concept of the mind's eye in any way a map onto Professor Seth's description of human consciousness?
Well, I'm not familiar with his theory, but probably any theory of cognition has room for something like mind. So my mind's eye is basically the kind of a place where what you're currently thinking of is being represented. So the idea is that, you know, in your brain, you've got this vast store of knowledge which you've gained, but when you're actually doing something, you're planning to go home for the first time, you're thinking of something which you've never thought before, some new problem arises. And so somewhere you have to bring together for the first time information which you need for that. So I call it a mind's eye, so some people call it a mental blackboard. I think consciousness, some people use in that sense, that it's the place where you store what you're conscious of. Any cognitive theory needs something like that, where you bring together the information relevant to the current decision you're making. But So in my system, this what's in your mind's eye, it could be filled with information of what you're seeing, but similarly, it could be filled in entirely with information from your memory, from what you're thinking. Okay, so you could be thinking about some abstract theory of physics or politics, and you can fill up your mind with constructions from this. And what the correspondence between what you're thinking about and reality could be anything. It depends how good these theories are which you're thinking about. So I think there's absolutely no guarantee that what you're thinking about has any correspondence to reality, as long as if the theories you're using to construct what's in your mind follows theories which are wrong. So the main point of this mind's eye is that that's also where you do kind of planning. You see what you see, and then somehow you make a plan. So if this is the current situation, what will happen next? So you update in your mind's eye what's likely to happen next. So it's a very essential part of living. It's like making predictions about what's going to happen, using the knowledge you have of what's likely to happen given a situation. So what I try to emphasize is that once you deal with learned knowledge, which you can't verify, then what you imagine could be, there are no limits to what you could be imagining there. It doesn't have to be a correspondence with reality. Although obviously the original purpose was to have a good representation of reality so you can cope with it.
Mind's eye, would it be close to something we call our ability to imagine things?
Sure. So that's where you, that's the place where you put together a situation in your mind which you're thinking about, yeah. So certainly when you're thinking, planning, yeah. Yes, exactly, yes.
And I do want to remind folks that we are talking to Leslie Valiant, professor of computer science and applied mathematics at Harvard University, about artificial intelligence, what we can learn about human cognition from our attempts to develop AI, and his new book, The Importance of Being Educable, A New Theory of Human Uniqueness.
Yeah, so we've been kind of touching on AI here and there. And in the development of AI, can you clarify the differences between the symbolic, which I think I have some surface level understanding of what that might mean, versus the connectionist approaches, and maybe how your work might fill the gaps between these two, the symbolic and the connectionist?
Yes, it's a good question. So I think this symbolic versus connectionist dichotomy probably arose back in the 1960s when different people were working these different approaches. But I think I think now it's probably makes less sense. So if you do machine learning, then in some sense, inside the learning box, if you're just anxious to predict something accurately, you don't care what's going on inside the box. And it can be a bunch of connections, numbers, which update themselves. And the only criterion is that it should predict accurately. But then the outputs of these boxes should be symbolic, so we understand what it means. You understand it's predicting rain, or it's predicting the presence of an elephant. So I think whether, for example, the learning method is symbolic or connectionist isn't so important. The main thing is how well it works. So I suppose in the 1960s, one approach to AI was just not doing any learning, but just doing reasoning. So taking on classical logic as a method of deducing from current knowledge future knowledge. So this thing didn't work out too well, but I suppose this is the high point of the symbolic approach, where when you formalize logic, it's extremely, extremely symbolic. So I think the dichotomy isn't so good because obviously what you're doing should be symbolic, because the outputs have to be symbolic, because you want to be able to explain what the system is predicting. So if the system is predicting the next word or gives you a sentence, that's very symbolic. But inside the predictor, exactly whether it's what kind of symbols it has or whether it's got numbers, which represent the connectionist approach, I mean, it shouldn't matter so much. So anyway, so I think with current systems have to be a hybrid of the two, I think. So, and certainly the everything I say about educability acknowledges the hybrid that you want to act in a world which is very symbolic. You make use language maybe to categorize what you're, how you're describing the world, but the your prediction methods may use any method you like, including what used to be called connectionist methods.
So I imagine you want a kind of hybrid symbolic and connectionist because they each kind of have strengths or advantages to them. Maybe could you touch on the advantages of symbolic and connectionist, and maybe if there are disadvantages too of kind of each approach, and why the hybrid sort of makes it the best recipe for success.
So I think the depends what we're talking about. So if you're going inside the learning algorithm and you say, should that be connectionist or symbolic, then, you know, that seems to be a kind of a false question, because you should obviously go to the one which is just more effective for your purpose. And for very large data sets, certainly the connectionist ones, or the ones which have numbers in, ones which do numerical optimization, are the most effective. On the other hand, if you go overboard in the connectionist world, then you say we should just have a single big box which predicts everything, and you assume that the human mind is just one big large language model. And I think that's the wrong way to go, because the outputs you expect from your system needs to be more symbolic, because you want to describe the world, say in words. And certainly if you want to do anything like reasoning, then symbols have to appear at a lower level. So maybe going back to a question which one of you was asking earlier, but we didn't quite pursue. So the question is, if you can do machine learning effectively, or in other words, if you have these large language models, what else should you add to make things more capable in a cognitive direction? Then the obvious answer is that you should have more of a capability for reasoning, something which resembles our reasoning capability more explicitly. So what's going on now is that these large language models, all they're trained for is prediction, predicting the next syllable. But in fact, you know, when you read some of these, the answers it texts it produces, you think, oh, sometimes it's doing good reasoning, sometimes it's doing bad reasoning. But I think in my view, whether it's doing good or bad reasoning is kind of arbitrary, and we can't rely on it to do good reasoning. So if we want it to do better reasoning, then we have to do something more, which is more like in the direction of traditional logic, which is more symbolic. So very basic. The basic answer is that you need to be more symbolic if you want to be able to describe the world in more detail in terms of words. But you shouldn't preclude. You shouldn't limit yourself in what learning method you use underneath.
Are there steps being made to actually add that component to the large language models, or does it have to be a whole different paradigm?
Well, so I've been talking about this for a long time, and my book addresses this. I'm not quite sure. I think the what's going on in industry with the large language models is that the temptation to just make the same thing but make it bigger and spend more money, so in fact you can do the same thing but more accurately, it's temptation is so large that people just do the same thing on a bigger scale. And that's an effective way of making progress. So it would be new learning experience to try to do things a different way. So I don't think adding learning to large language models is being pursued yet in a serious way. But I think that's the way to go.
Considering the supercharged, emotionally engaged, politically polarized environment that we're experiencing nowadays, the elephant in the room is just what we've been talking about, reasoned thinking. And in addition to reasoned thinking, we're saying the large language models don't have. The other thing that seems to be missing in an approach to AI is our affective processes, because those really come into play in the political polarized realm that we live in. That's the realm of values and emotions. How does that human affect and values and emotions fit into emulating human cognition? Do we have to include that component to actually have AI, meaning that it's emulating human cognition?
So as far as reasoning, so certainly as I've already mentioned, so I think because of this large amount of learning that we do to acquire our skills, the areas in which we do formal reasoning every day is fairly small. Okay, so much of our actions are learned actions, and we're easily influenced by what we hear, other people's theories. And we don't actually use reasoning every day to decide on our actions, because our actions are often decided by what we learn. So, I mean, affective phenomena. So I don't think that they're something difficult to deal with, in the sense that you can always declare some. In a computer, you can also declare some belief a computer has, or some behavior of a computer as being the computer's affective behavior. So the data which a computer may be given may be the result of human affective behavior, and it usually is. So I don't think the source of the information or the behavior is so important, whether it's effective or whether it's based on some very dry logic. I think we process it in the same way. And I think if one has an approach to cognition which is equally sympathetic to learned behavior, which I think is most of our behavior, with some reasoning capability put on top, then I think one can encompass human affective behavior. So I don't think that's an issue.
Okay, I think maybe getting into another key concept, kind of shifting gears here. Another key concept in your theory is an educable learning system, or ELS. Could you maybe just like describe what that is to us?
Well, that's just a summary of what this capability of educability is. So in the book, I try to define it fairly formally. So basically, it's a characterization that it's a system which can do this learning from examples, which is what current AI does. On top of it, it can chain together its conclusions and apply its conclusions from this learning. And third, it can also gain knowledge from other beings who've given it explicit instructions, like by an algorithm or computer. And it can integrate all these three aspects into one capability, which is what we humans have. So this educable learning system is just a definition of what I believe our basic capability is of educability. It's a summary of what the theory is.
Okay, well, we're getting close to the sand in our hourglass running out. So I'm going to skip to a question that really relates what we've been talking about to the central theme in our program. And it'll get us back to talking a little bit about the role and the difference maybe between an approach to building something called artificial intelligence and what human beings really do experience, which includes their emotions and sense of identity and all that kind of thing. How does the inherent capability of being educable mesh with the central theme and pack learning mesh with the central theme of our show, which is that learning and practicing evidence-based critical thinking can improve our accuracy in assessing and conceptualizing reality, and that an accurate cognitive mapping of reality gives us survival advantages to us and our species?
Yeah, okay, so that's a great question. So in the book, I do have one section called Teaching to Reason, where I do say that, you know, one of the things responsible for our civilization is that we've learned new methods of reasoning and educated people about them. So I think critical thinking is clearly, which I do mention, has got this goal. So I also mentioned some basic mathematical notions, like the fact that we assign probabilities to events helps us to estimate the likelihood of certain things happening. And this method of reasoning had to be invented. Similarly, in algebra, you say let X be this unknown. So this is a powerful method of reasoning. This had to be invented, and then it's taught, and everyone can use it. So I think teaching to reason is great, and I think, you know, it's obviously is a big part of what makes for our civilization. But I think what I've become aware of in writing the book is that there's serious problems which this doesn't quite address. So for example, so I mentioned that in the book that some theories which we later on regard as unconscionable can take over societies, like some societies have had human sacrifice. So if you're born in a society where everyone accepts a human sacrifice, then probably I don't think by critical thinking you can get out of believing in it. You probably believe in that theory because that's how you grow up. So, but I think if you become more conscious of this educability view of the world, which is to recognize that, you know, what we believe is a result of our can be a result of our learning algorithms. So, for example, if you keep hearing the same thing every day, you're going to believe it, whether it's true or not. Then you've got a more you've got an angle on how to challenge what you're being told. So in the book, I mentioned that. So our current problem is that some people believe theories which they're told, which may not be true, and I think defending society against this is difficult, and certainly teaching them reasoning methods is good, but I think the situation is more difficult because so one distinction I also make in the book is that if you study learning, you realize that in your learning the world can be is usually, I think, neutral. That the world isn't trying to help you learn or hinder you learn. Now, teacher tries to help you learn, but the world can also be adversarial, that the world may is trying to make sure that you don't learn, and or that you learn false things. So propaganda is a way which I think it exploits your learning mechanisms in an adversarial way, where they teach you things which are in someone else's interest. So I think to defend against this, I think taking very seriously education, where you alert people about the techniques people use in propaganda, which would be to exploit our basic learning methods, but in a adversarial way, I think would be another way of protecting ourselves against beliefs which are not good for us. So just learning better reasoning methods is certainly very valuable, but I think I've become conscious also of this second aspect.
we just have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to throw a big question at you, but do the best you can in a couple minutes with this. What are your views on the healthy coexistence of AI and human beings? Remember my polarized statements about, you know, it's either going to be the destruction of human civilization or the best thing since sliced bread. But what are your views on the peaceful coexistence and the healthy coexistence of AI and human beings?
Yes, it's a great question. And yeah, so I certainly, my opinion is in the middle between those extremes. So I think if you define a task precisely enough, then you will be able to make a computer do it well, and possibly better than humans. So, you know, given enough effort, I think, you know, any human skill you can probably get a computer to do. We shouldn't be insulted by this. But where I see in the future is that it's going to be like a mixed economy, that humans will do some things, machines will do some things. So one example I have is chess. So one would have thought that when computers become better than humans at chess, then humans will stop playing chess. But that hasn't happened. It's a mixed economy. Some humans like playing humans. Some humans like playing computers. Okay, and I think this is, I expect, I hope that this is going to be continuing in other realms, that for some things people may prefer to get the services from computers and others from humans, and that it's going to be a mixed economy.
Julia, any last thoughts about what we've been talking about?
I'm still taking it all in.
Well, we all are. Professor Valiant, thanks so much for taking the time with us to share your expertise. And I want to really give you personal congratulations on your long and wonderful work in computer science and theoretical computer science. So on our Facebook page, we will post links to your faculty page at Harvard, your Wikipedia page, and your Turing Award page. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
Well, that seems more than enough.
And a big thanks to our listeners out there for your support. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.